Welcome back to the UFO Rabbit Hole podcast. I'm your host, Kelly Chase. This week's episode barely felt like work because this week I sat down with my dear friend and one of my favorite people, Jay Christopher King. Jay is the co-founder and director of the Experiencer Group, a private online community dedicated to support, curiosity, and community for people who've had anomalous experiences of all kinds. He's also the co-founder of the phenomenal Inquire Anomalous Conference Series in New York City, along with James Iandoli. In its first year, Inquire Anomalous put on three conferences, each with an all-star slate of speakers that included Gary Nolan, Leslie Kane, Ralph Blumenthal, Ryan Graves, Christopher Mellon, Jeff Kripal, Whitley Strieber, Brandon Fugel, James Fox, Peter Lavenda, Mitch Horowitz, and many more. These conferences have quickly become the hottest ticket in the world of ufology and anomalous studies, and for good reason. What Jay and James have created with this conference series is something totally unique and desperately needed. Inquire Anomalous is an intimate gathering of some of the top minds in the field, where they can share their latest thinking and cutting-edge research on the phenomenon. This serious, academic approach to the topic, paired with a willingness to fearlessly explore the full scope of this vast field, from nuts and bolts and Washington insiders to the far stranger landscapes of anomalous experience, has made Inquire Anomalous a lightning rod for the growing energy of this current moment. I was lucky enough to be asked to co-host the first two of these conferences, and it's honestly hard to describe how special these events are. It's really something that you just have to experience for yourself, and I'm so grateful that I've had that opportunity. And having gotten some hints from Jay about what is planned for upcoming events, all I can say is that you're definitely going to want to stay tuned to see what they do next. And luckily, if you can't make it out to New York, you can find the talks from the Inquire Anomalous series on their YouTube channel, which is truly all killer, no filler. I'll put the link in the episode brief so that you can check that out. Before we dive into my conversation with Jay, I just want to acknowledge that this episode is going to be particularly challenging for some of you. Jay is a profound and lifelong experiencer who has had ongoing encounters with non-human intelligences that have deeply informed his work and his understanding of this field. Which isn't to say that he thinks he has all the answers. If you listen to Jay, what you'll hear is someone who brings a deep humility to the subject. He's the first to tell you that he doesn't know what his experiences mean. But as someone who's had these encounters throughout his life, he doesn't have the luxury of hiding his head in the sand with the willfully agnostic stance on non-human entities that is the ontological refuge of so many in the field. And I want to be very clear about what I mean by that. Even among those who are convinced of the reality of the UFO phenomenon and the presence of non-human intelligence on this planet, you'll see something very interesting, which is this. Most people are willing to believe in the existence of non-human intelligence right up until the point that anyone actually interacts with one. At that point, they slam on the brakes, the walls go up, and all of the biases and stigma that they've worked so hard to overcome in the public sphere comes rushing back. The assumption immediately becomes that the person relating this encounter must be crazy or mistaken or lying. I understand that impulse and the deep cognitive dissonance that comes along with it, and I think it's really natural and even a rational response to information that is so utterly out of alignment with our everyday experience of reality. Because let's not mince words here. Encounters with non-human intelligence are deeply and profoundly weird. They operate by a kind of dream logic or seemingly by no logic at all. The beings behave in ways that defy all of our expectations and assumptions about how an advanced intelligence might present itself to us. And in the end, these experiences leave us with far more questions than they do answers. And it's not just because they sound hard to believe. It's that they leave us with so little to believe in. Acknowledging the reality of these encounters shatters our worldview, even for many of us who've deeply immersed ourselves in this field, and leaves us with very little to hold on to, only a yawning ontological cavern. In my own journey, I found that no amount of study could fully get me to a place of acceptance with regards to these types of encounters. Even the integration of my own profound anomalous experiences was somehow not enough to totally overcome my deep suspicion and sense of unease when confronted with these sorts of stories. No matter how much I pushed myself to be open-minded, it was always there lurking in the background. There are some types of knowledge that can only be gained through relationships with others. And I've found that this is often the case with accepting the strange reality of encounters with non-human intelligence. In building friendships with people whose lives have been filled with such encounters, I've discovered that they consistently defy the stereotype of the uneducated, grandiose, and likely mentally ill experiencer that we're consistently pushed through the media. Quite to the contrary, the experiencers that I know are, by and large, intelligent, humble, grounded, and highly functioning people who care deeply about others and about making a positive impact on the world. They aren't seeking attention or trying to make a buck off their stories. In fact, most of the experiencers that I know very rarely share that part of their lives with others and have a very small circle of people in whom they are able to confide. That's why I'm so grateful to Jay for doing the work that he does and being willing to have this conversation with me in such a public way. There are no rewards for saying any of this stuff aloud. There are only liabilities. It takes a rare level of integrity and bravery to be willing to do so. Jay and I have gotten to know each other pretty well over the last year. We've met up at conferences, we've traveled together, I've stayed in his home, we've collaborated on projects, and we've had hours and hours of conversations about everything under the sun. I feel very confident that I know who Jay is. I trust him, I respect him, and I believe him. But I don't expect those of you who are challenged by this conversation to believe Jay just because I do. That's never been how things work around here at the UFO rabbit hole. I would never ask you to leave your skepticism at the door. The only thing I've ever asked of you is that you don't let the place where your skepticism begins be the place where your thinking stops. And so I wanted to front-load this conversation with some very important context that I think might make it a little easier to approach this intellectually. The reality is that encounters with even just the physical craft associated with the phenomenon are far more strange than is typically conveyed through the popular nuts and bolts narrative. And if we're going to remain objective as we grapple with this topic, that strangeness is not something that we can just ignore. In the episode brief, I've shared a link to a 2003 article written by Jacques Vallée and Eric Davis entitled Incommensurability, Orthodoxy, and the Physics of High Strangeness, a Six-Layer Model. Don't let that name scare you off. It's a fairly short paper, and though the ideas themselves are challenging, it's a fairly easy read, and it's definitely worth your time. And there are a couple of ideas from that article that I want to quickly talk through before we begin that I think will help to better frame this conversation. First of all, drawing from Vallée's decades of work on the phenomenology of UFOs, as well as from the database of the National Institute of Discovery Sciences, Vallée and Davis propose a six-layer model of the phenomenon. Each of these six layers represents a category of various aspects of the phenomenon that appear frequently in reports of UFO encounters. These layers are physical, anti-physical, psychological, physiological, psychic, and cultural. Now, I don't want to get in the weeds here, so for the purposes of this conversation, we're just going to look at the psychic layer of the phenomenon. According to Vallée and Davis, the following psychic phenomena are frequently associated with UFO encounters: impressions of communications without a direct sensory channel, poltergeist phenomena, levitations of witnesses or objects, maneuvers of a UAP appearing to anticipate the witness's thoughts, and premonitory dreams or visions. And yes, this is challenging to talk about for many, and there are no easy answers here. But this is the reality of what we're often dealing with when we talk about UFO encounters, drawn from thousands of cases investigated over decades. And no matter how much we might want to do so, we can't just throw out the data points that make us uncomfortable if we want to remain objective. And the second idea that I wanted to pull out of this paper is that of the incommensurability problem. Vallée and Davis explain the incommensurability problem like this, quote, "At the core of the incommensurability problem is the view that no intelligent species can understand reality without making certain methodological choices, and that these choices may vary from civilization to civilization. If ETs and UAP entities have different biologies and live in considerably different environments from humans, they may well have different goals for their science and radically different criteria for evaluating the success of their science. Their explanatory mechanisms, their predictive concerns, their modes of control over nature might all be very different, and their means of formulating models of reality should be expected to differ drastically from ours. End quote. In short, we know very little about the intelligence behind UFOs. We don't know where it comes from, what it wants, or what it values. We don't know how its technology works or its scientific models. We don't know what its sensory experience is like, nor the extent to which that sensory experience might or might not overlap with our own. And it's very likely that in all of our attempts to try to conceptualize what this intelligence might be like, we are grossly underestimating how truly alien it might be to us, and unintentionally projecting our own anthropomorphized view of reality onto it. You can see this all the time in discussions about UFOs and non-human intelligence. For example, you'll often hear people make the argument that it doesn't make sense that a non-human civilization would have technology advanced enough to fly thousands of light years to get here, only to have those ships crash when they arrive. It's one of those arguments that sounds reasonable and objective, but in reality, it's anything but. It's an argument that is constructed out of layers of entirely baseless and unsupported assumptions about the nature of the phenomenon. And that's something that we need to constantly guard ourselves against in this field. If we don't constantly question our biases, if we aren't acutely and constantly aware that we don't know what we don't know, we can easily end up discarding data points that we deem to be too ridiculous that might actually be the key to cracking this whole thing open. And so I'm not asking you to believe anything that you hear today. I'm only asking that you listen and that you consider it. You don't need to come to any conclusions. Jay certainly hasn't, and neither have I. These are just data points to add to the pile. The past few weeks have been some of the most significant in the history of this topic, with UFO whistleblower David Grush alleging that certain special access programs are in possession of not just non-human technology and craft, but bodies. It's only a matter of time before the tenor of this conversation shifts, and we're confronted with the reality of actual non-human entities. And so I'd suggest that there has literally never been a better time to get over our squeamishness about the fact that these beings exist and that they've likely been interacting with humanity in various ways for decades, if not much longer than that. People who outright reject that idea and refuse to engage with it are going to have a much bumpier ride in the months and years to come. All right, so let's dive into it. Here is my conversation with J. Christopher King.
So I feel like a great place to start would be to ask, what is an experiencer? Because I think the answer to that question is maybe more complicated than people might imagine.
Oh, what a great question. All right. Thanks, Kelly. I mean, a definition that we often see, if you just put in experiencer on Google, you might see that an experiencer is an entity that receives a sensory impression. So, you know, by that definition, basically any living thing could be an experiencer. An experiencer in this sense, however, is a term that was popularized by Dr. John Mack back in the early 90s. As you know, Dr. Mack was the head of psychiatry at Harvard for many years. He was a great writer that won a Pulitzer. He was a noted expert on nightmares and child development. So luckily, he was the kind of person that was perfect to look seriously at cases of non-human entity contact and what are often called abduction cases. He preferred the term experiencer to abductee, and towards the end of his life, he opened up the term to people that were also having out-of-body experiences, for example. So since then, it's taken on an even wider meaning, and now it's often used to refer to anyone that has had what are thought of in Western consensus culture as anomalous experiences. That could be out-of-body encounters, near-death experiences, precognitive dreams, NHI or UAP contact, people that have experienced what are thought of as hauntings, psi, and even ESP modalities. So it's a wide range, because what we found over the years is that many people that experience one modality often later have experiences with another.
So can you talk people through a little bit about what the Experiencer Group is and why you started it?
Sure. The Experiencer Group is a unique and private, pay-what-you-wish member site dedicated to support, curiosity, and community for those who've lived through anomalous events of any and all kinds, like what we just mentioned. The first thing people see when they join is that we have a custom-built social media interface that looks and functions similar to other traditional forms of social media. There, experiencers can post and engage with each other, direct message each other, compare notes. Though a key component that's really at the heart of the community are a series of regular private live stream events, usually via Zoom. We hold weekly support meetings for experiencers, which many find to be a profound center point for processing what's happened in their lives and exploring these mysteries. We also have a dream study group, a book club, a study group called Exploring Consciousness, a series called Current Events in Anomalous Culture, where we have special guests come in and have open conversations with the community. For example, most recently, after the House UAP hearing, we had the director, Randall Nickerson, who made Aerial Phenomenon, join us. And we also had Daniel Elizondo, aka Omega Point, who co-wrote the amazing, amazing document Loose Threads last year. They'd never met before, and I knew that they'd complement each other pretty well. It was a great conversation, and we were able to kind of take the temperature of where everyone's at with these disclosure initiatives on Capitol Hill and elsewhere.
So when people come and seek out the Experiencer Group, what sorts of things are they needing support with in terms of their interaction with anomalous experiences?
Sure. There are a few different kind of basic categories that I find myself looking at when they walk in the door. There's often people that are processing ontological shock, and sometimes that presents itself in different ways. Some people kind of process it or are thinking of it as kind of a spiritual emergency in a way, in terms of recognizing that the world is truly a lot weirder than it's been made out to be. And really processing and considering that worldview can take time and can be really challenging for a lot of folks. They're sometimes processing traumatic experiences that they've had. And often, and sometimes these people have already gone through their periods of ontological shock, and they're really there to find friends, to find other people that have experienced the situation. There are people from all over, and I think it's really amazing to see how supportive and helpful those that have processed, integrated, and are more kind of secure in their lives and secure in their careers, but supporting others that are just starting to figure things out, I guess. There's also a lot of people that join. They're trying to navigate consensus reality. There are a lot of folks that, you know, they can't talk about this stuff at work. They don't want anybody to know that this is happening to them. Sometimes that's because what they do, it would be a huge liability if they were out on the internet talking about how they live in a haunted house or how, you know, they encountered grays when they were kids or anything along these lines, or that they're plagued with terrifying or amazing precognitive dreams that typically come true. There's a lot of folks out there, and I think that the navigation of consensus reality and Western consensus culture, you know, that comparing notes about that is one of the most common things that I see in, say, support group sessions.
I love that about the Experiencer Group. And I feel like it's always really interesting whenever I'm at a conference or just hanging out with other people in the community, the ability to just say out loud what actually happened to you or the things that you're actually thinking about instead of trying to, as you're speaking, run it through this filter where you're trying to, you know, like, how much can I say without scaring people? How much can I say without someone thinking I'm crazy? It's such a relief sometimes to just be able to give voice to the thing that you are always trying not to say.
Completely agreed. Completely agreed. It's really mentally taxing, right? The self-editing that people have to do often, it can be a real challenge. And I'm just thinking of so many people in the community that have situations like this. I mean, there are a lot, you know, maybe we can get into this more later in the conversation, but there are a lot of researchers and writers in this field that are very regular experiencers that have kind of psi or ESP situations happen and a lot of kind of inconvenient truths, as it were, along those lines. And it's amazing to see folks bridge that gap or kind of cross that bridge in terms of when you meet a new friend in ufology or in the wider realm of anomalous studies. And then, you know, there's kind of a dot, dot, dot. And then you get to hear about some of those wild experiences and how regular they might be. I've been surprised sometimes at the folks that I know. And I think a lot of listeners would be too, you know, folks that are really known for like nuts and bolts ufology, for example, that their private experiences and their private lives are much, much stranger than thinking about exotic propulsion or something along those lines.
Yeah, absolutely. It's enough of a social risk to say that you study the phenomenon and that's what your whole life is about. But to say that it shows up in your bedroom sometimes is a different conversation that it feels like a lot of people aren't ready to have. So I'm really grateful that you provided a space for people to talk about that. And I'm sure a lot of other people are as well. So if people are listening and they're interested in the experiencer group, who would you say is a good fit for the experiencer group?
Oh, sure. Let's see. It's a great question. We seem to attract like a particularly thoughtful and bright range of people. I'm not exactly why that is, but I love that. You know, it's something that might surprise folks. A lot of people that are looking for a community like the Experiencer Group are actually super high functioning. And some people don't like that term, but it can be incredibly appropriate considering that these are folks that are like probably a lot of your listeners that are really working through things that have happened in their lives and that might continually be happening in their lives and that they still have to put on their pants and go to work in the morning. And that takes a certain level of really amazing functioning, to be perfectly frank. And so who's a good fit for the experiencer group? We're really open. It's funny, on the site, when people join or if people are just looking at the site, we really try to be very non-judgmental, very open. You know, if we were a church, which we absolutely are not, it would probably be closer to Unitarianism, you know, like a very comparativist group. I think comparativism is probably a good theme in terms of, you know, some people, they're in the midst of a spiritual emergency or they're really struggling with these experiences and that can be something where they want clear answers. They want simple answers. And we can't provide those. You know, you can't, I can't, nobody really can. These are enduring mysteries. And so I think one thing is that the experiencer group, the people that stick around and the people that really are kind of at the center point of the community are folks that enjoy exploring and they enjoy living in the mystery. And they enjoy collecting what they can find and meeting other people and collecting these puzzle pieces, but really kind of being able to swim in the mystery, you know?
I love that. And I've really enjoyed being a part of the experiencer group and getting to know people who are experiencers. And something that's so striking to me is what you said about so many of these people being very high functioning. Like, I think we should clarify that we don't even necessarily mean high functioning for an experiencer, but like high functioning compared to just the general population, right? These are so many.
Yeah.
It's just so counter to the idea that we're given in the media that these are people who are maybe less educated or less in touch with reality or who are living some weird fringy existence. Like a lot of these people are very successful and have huge bodies of work and are very well known in their fields outside of all of this. And I just find that really interesting. And I wish in some ways that it didn't make it easier for me to identify as an experiencer, but it does. It does make it easier.
Yeah. I mean, you're absolutely right. We've got doctors, lawyers, people that have had high positions at Fortune 500 companies. It's a really broad range of folks. And then there are tons of artists and musicians that are known in their own right and things like that. And I love that. I think it's amazing. And it's a highly literate group. You know, we've got a lot of readers. We've got a ton of podcast listeners. That's for sure. And I love that about it. And I think that like attracts like. And often when people come in the door and they see that it's not kind of like the low level of conversation that'll often happen in a venue like Facebook or something like that. And it doesn't have the animosity that people find on X, aka Twitter, these days. There's none of that. We don't let in trolls. We don't let in folks that are mean-spirited. If we find that they are, they get booted immediately. We make no promises in terms of how long people will be able to be members. And so it gives us a lot of leeway in terms of just, it's a considered a private community. So we can kind of do whatever we want that way. And so if somebody acts out or acts inappropriately, we don't ask them to leave. They're just gone. And luckily, because of the kind of tone that happens within the group, that doesn't happen very often. What I find is that it seems like if there are any mean-spirited people that get in the door, they see that it's a well-functioning community and they get bored and they leave. So that's great. I love that.
Yeah, no, that is amazing. So we've been friends for a while, and I think you've gotten to see a lot of my own journey with it. And when I started, I considered myself to be open-minded, and I didn't consider myself at any point to be like just the nuts and bolts type, because I was interested in consciousness and all this other stuff. But I think I really suffered from something that I see so much in general with people who are new to this topic, which is that I was willing to believe in non-human intelligence up into the point that someone actually interacted with one, at which point the assumption is that they're crazy or they're mistaken or they're lying or something, right? And for me, so much of integrating and understanding more about the phenomenon has been hearing from and getting to know people who I do really respect and who I do think are really smart, who I know have had these like really profound experiences. And you're one of those people in my life that's really helped me to understand that. So first of all, thank you. And second of all, I was hoping you might be willing to share a little bit with the listeners about what your own journey as an experiencer has been, because obviously you didn't just start the experiencer group out of nowhere. You've had your own experiences. So would you care to walk us through that and how this all started for you?
Sure. Well, I appreciate you saying that. And thanks for asking. I don't often talk about my own history of anomalous experiences, partially because I often don't want that to be the headline. It almost always turns into kind of like the headline, if that's what I do. But I'm happy to share with you, and I'm happy if it helps the community and helps your listeners navigate, for sure. Where do I begin? Well, the first experience that I had was actually when I was about 4 years old in Fort Wayne, Indiana. I was in my bedroom, and I have a very distinct sense memory of this experience. It's kind of one of those, you know how when you're a kid, like basically by the time you're an adult, some of those early experiences, it's almost only the oh shit moments, like the, oh, I can't put my hand on this burner, or that pipe is super hot, or don't fall out of a tree, or whatever it is along those lines.
Yeah. Right?
And this was like totally an oh shit moment. So I'm in my room and pushing like a plastic bin of toys across the floor, which was something that was pretty much my job at that point, pushing toys across the floor. And as I did, these two, I don't know any other way to say it, these two light beings showed up in the room kind of instantaneously, just off to my left and maybe 4 to 5 feet in front of me. And, one somehow seemed a little bit more masculine and one somehow seemed a little bit more feminine. And I just kind of clocked them. I looked at them and I was amazed, you know? And at that age, you're still learning about reality. You're still learning about the world. And so I'm actually really happy that that experience happened so early, because I really think it kind of opened the doors a little bit to my perception. And I'm glad that it was a positive experience. I'm glad that my first experience was a positive experience. So these two beings, they show up and somehow they're telepathically communicating with me. Like words and feelings were showing up in my head. And I felt this like real warmth. I felt like I was getting projected this feeling of love. And they kind of in a somewhat uniform way, like they looked like two figures. And they were communicating like a unified message in some way, which is interesting. And it was this message like, we know you, we've known you for a really long time, and we're coming to you now because later we won't be able to do this. And I think my response at that point was like, okay. Like, I didn't know what to think. I had no idea what to think about this situation. And I was just getting this intense feeling of love. And they're like, so we're visiting you now. We're not going to be able to visit you later, but you'll remember this, basically. And then it was kind of like, we have to go now. And I said, okay. And they kind of blipped out. And that was it. That was the first experience that I had. And looking back, I'm so thankful that that happened. And I don't know why. I don't know who those beings were. I don't know where they came from. I don't know where they were going. I don't know exactly why they seemed to have some understanding of me that would have gone back like before my current life or something like that. It seems to imply something about maybe reincarnation or something about some kind of prior existence before we're children. But I, at the end of the day, I don't know. I don't know exactly where they came from. I don't know who they were, but I'm very thankful. And so then I ran into the kitchen / breakfast table area and I was like, mom, you know, I saw these beings that were in the room and da, 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 da. And I recounted it to her and she was like, oh, that's great. And she was, you know, she's total like kind of a Dr. Spock reader, as many were in the times. Dr. Spock is this, I don't know if anybody still reads Dr. Spock, who's this guy that was very, very popular among parents back in the 70s, 80s, and 90s on childhood development and stuff like that. And so, you know, I think she thought she was pretty prepared for this conversation. And she was like, oh, that's cool, honey. Those are called imaginary friends and you're probably going to have them for a while. And that is totally cool. Yeah, no worries there. And so on the one hand, I was pretty psyched that my mom was understanding about the situation in a way, but it also, there was like already a little bit of a schism where she didn't seem to understand that these were real beings that had thoughts and were communicating with me that somehow blipped into the room and blipped out. And so, you know, it was an early taste that this was not a usual situation, that this was not something that people normally experienced, I guessed, or that people talked about, and that there were alternative explanations for what was happening here.
I can totally see where your mom was coming from. But it is so interesting, this idea that it would be an imaginary friend, because, I mean, just think about the implications of what you were told, right? Even though you were so young, I'm sure that it opened you up to possibilities and ideas that you wouldn't have considered before, like some sort of existence outside of your human existence or before your human existence. And for you to make that up, that would be a big thought for a four-year-old to have, right?
You'd think, right? You'd think. And to this day, like, my mom has heard me recount this story in a couple other situations, both interpersonally and on one or two other podcasts. And every time that she listens to it, I get a call and she's like, yeah, I'm still really sorry about that. And I'm like, I'm not telling the story to make you feel shame, mom. That's not what this is about, you know?
Yeah.
Because since then, as we'll get into, my mom and I and many other folks have had shared experiences alongside of different modalities. And so my mom and I have wide shared history in this field and with this subject matter and in terms of just really hardcore lived experience. And so, you know, I'm sorry, mom. I'm really sorry. Yet again, I'm sorry, but I'm not sorry because it's a good story and I'm glad people can hear it now. So after that experience, going ahead from 4 years old to 6 years old, we moved from Fort Wayne to Mishawaka, this town in northern Indiana near South Bend. And we lived in an old house. It was a big house. It was larger than the home that we were in Fort Wayne. My dad was making a little bit more money as an electrical engineer. And we moved in. And even just the very first night, the movers used these hand trucks to bring in heavy, like, book boxes that I think were my dad's old textbooks and journals and stuff like that. He carried them around everywhere. I'm sure he still has them somewhere. So these stacked up heavy boxes came down the stairs and they came down through the kitchen, through the back door and downstairs into the basement. And they were just left there like pillars of book boxes. And in the morning, my mom went downstairs and freaked out because the boxes had been moved around and were kind of aligned in like a checkerboard pattern across the floor of the basement. And she freaked out and she yelled for my dad to come downstairs. Dad went downstairs and he was a, you know, electrical engineer, very rational, logic-minded person. Well, there's got to be an explanation for that. You know, we'll get the keys changed. And the first thought for both my mom and my dad was that somebody was screwing with them, that somebody was trying to fool them or trick them or scare them. And then later, while the move was still happening, because we got there late, the book boxes came in just because they were holding the beds in the right spot. So the next day, when this is still fresh in their minds, stuff's still coming in the back door and mom is tracking where the movers are. And she goes out into the backyard from the kitchen and she comes back and the door of the oven is open and the oven is turned on all the way up from out of nowhere and almost instantaneously. And she says that just she immediately had this kind of cognitive flip moment, like what Jeff Kripal describes in a way. And immediately she had this knowing or an assumption of what it was. And she said, I don't know who you are, but this is my house now. This is my house now. It's not yours. Don't do that. And that day started a long series over several years. My parents divorced in that house, by the way. They separated from that house. My dad went on to live there by himself for a period of months waiting for the house to sell. And I can't even imagine what it was like for him, but there were ghost figures. There were kind of shadow people. There was a lot of poltergeist activity. Cereal bowls would shoot across the coffee table right in front of me while I'm watching cartoons. And my mom, it's interesting because my mom blocked some of this stuff out. And I was talking to her a couple of years ago and she was saying like she had just remembered that a common thing that happened was her reaching for the keys on the kitchen counter, the keys like jumping out from her reach. And she was like, Jay, why did I forget that? How could I have forgotten that? And then once she uncovered it, she remembered that it wasn't the only time that that happened. And she was kind of amazed. And she was like, you know, you've talked about how often the poltergeist activity happened for you. And I've just been stumped because I didn't remember it happening as daily as you recall it to be. But now I'm not so sure anymore. Because if I'd forgotten that, if I'd somehow buried that memory, like, what else did I forget? And why did that happen? These are great questions, right? And I love exploring those kinds of questions. And I'm glad that there are people in my life and the whole experiencer group community to be able to explore those topics.
We're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back. Is that something that you see or hear a lot from other experiencers, that maybe they've had an anomalous experience that they've completely forgotten about? And then they remember later and they're like, oh my gosh, how did I forget that?
Absolutely. It happens all the time. It happens all the time. It's amazing. You know, there's this belief within the ufology community, and it's important to recognize that there are these cliches and there are these assumptions that each version of anomalous studies communities think. And one of them within ufology is that, you know, those bastards, those grays or whatever aliens we're talking about here or whatever NHI we're talking about here, they erase your thoughts. They erase your thoughts and they only leave you with fragmentary memories. And there does seem to be truth to that. When people have NHI encounters, people report being told that they're going to forget and that somehow people are made to forget some of these encounters. And at the same time, our brains seem to have an amazing capacity to chuck stuff into the recycling bin if it's traumatic or if it's something that doesn't adhere to the reality that people know. And I've seen that happen over and over and over again, and so have people within the community. It's amazing. It really is amazing. I'll go way forward and then we'll pull it back. But when I was in my early 20s, I was going to college. I was going to art school in New York, and I had a bunch of friends that went to SVA, School of Visual Arts, where I was going. And then I had a bunch of friends that went to NYU, which was right nearby. And we'd all hang out, smoke way too many cigarettes, all the stuff that kids do. And one of these friends came from a pretty like old, well-off family that actually owned a really small island near Cape Cod. And he would bring people out there. He's somebody that actually got known for his music, but I probably shouldn't name who he is. So this guy, it was normal for him maybe twice a year or so to bring like a good dozen of his friends out to this old kind of family vacation home. They had a couple on this island, right? And one night we were all out at the beach and we were walking back along this trail. And there's this old family graveyard kind of in the middle of the island. And I can't remember how many graves were there. It was a very old graveyard, though. And as we're walking towards the graveyard, and it's, again, like about a dozen of us or so, we're walking through the graveyard and about a dozen orbs show up in the graveyard. Now, some of them are small, about the size of a baseball. Some of them are about as big as a basketball. And they're just hovering there. And some of them are kind of moving around as if they had a thought or autonomy. And they're kind of being playful in a way, kind of moving towards us and moving back. And one of the people in our group had brought their digital camera to the beach and started taking pictures of these orbs. And some of the people had been drinking and some of the people had not been drinking. And there's a lot of, whoa, wow, what's that? You know, a lot of confusion, a lot of exclamations, and just kind of standing there for a period of minutes watching this happen. And then somebody's like, well, let's go back, you know? And so for whatever reason, there's just kind of this movement to get back to the house. And at least one of the orbs, I can't remember if more than one of them, but one of them came along with us and zipped up the path towards the house and back several times, kind of like a dog would. If you're out hiking with a dog and they like run up 50 yards, look at you and are like, are you going to speed up or what? And then they just come back. It was kind of like that. It's weird. So bizarre seeing this happen. And people are just like laughing and like, what the? Like, I can't even believe this. You know, these kinds of statements. We get back to the house and it puts on the show. It goes up first in like through the door and goes up the stairs, apparently. And we saw it put on this wild show where up in the second floor, people had left their doors open to their rooms, a couple of them. And you could see that the orb was moving along the hallway on the second floor from where we were in front of the house. And then it just disappeared. And for whatever reason, I can remember a lot of the nights there, but I don't remember what happened up. All right. Now, in the morning, we're having this big like brunch breakfast at this big long table. And one of the people that was there is like, so are we not going to talk about what happened last night? And the wild thing was, is that only about half of the people that were there remembered that it had happened. Wow. How wild is that? Yeah, already, like the next morning, only about half of them remembered that it happened. And it caused an argument, you know? And one of the people's like, I got pictures. I got digital pictures. They're right here. Like, I'm showing them to you right now. And one of the other people who's in media and is kind of known as this kind of very logical person was like, that didn't happen. He was just like super confident about it. Just amazingly, brazenly, like, nope, no way. You know, and I think it was one of the first times that I saw that his girlfriend, who later became his wife, there seemed to be like a difference of opinion on whether the orbs happened or not. But I just think that's amazing. And for years after that, I wondered, were we made to forget or what happened there? And now in my early 40s, I think it had more to do with our brain's capacity or incapacity to deal with strange situations.
Yeah, that makes sense. That's a crazy story. So rewinding a little bit, where should we pick the story back up?
So I lived in that house that would be what a lot of people would consider to be haunted, but I don't really know what it was. I'm not exactly sure what the source of that was. I actually got in touch a few years ago with the lady that, at least at that point, lived in that house. This was, I know, it was 2020, back when everybody was staring at the wall and staring at their belly button and stock of their last. And I was able to track down the lady that lived there. And I was like, hey, I used to live in your house. I remember it really well, back in the 80s. And I just had a couple strange questions for you. And if you don't want to answer, no worries. And she was like, go ahead, shoot. And I was like, is the house still haunted? And she was like, no, thanks, bye. Basically, she said it in a nice way, but she was pretty clear that she hadn't experienced anything like that. And I think that that's fascinating. Again, it's like, did it leave? Was it the kind of thing that's only perceptible to certain people? Is that kind of energy or those kinds of interactions attracted to only the kind of people that are predisposed to detecting it? What makes that kind of energy happen in a space? Like I said before, my parents were not having a happy marriage there. And some people have speculated in the past for years that somehow negative energy, like really strong negative energy between or negative interactions between people can be an attractor for that kind of poltergeist or dark energy. But at the end of the day, I'm not really sure. All I can do is collect data points and look at what happened and go from there. You know, there was a story people knew in the neighborhood. I'd heard from kids around that a kid had supposedly killed himself in the basement back maybe 10 years earlier. And I don't know if that's true. I don't know if that's kids being kids or if that's just the kind of received lore that kids traffic in, you know? But it is interesting that a lot of the activity seemed to start in the basement and that it would kind of move from there. And so lights would go on and off and stuff like that in the basement. And you could see that from the kitchen and then things would start happening there. It didn't always happen like that, but sometimes it did. So it is interesting to me that the story of the basement seemed to maybe be tied to that being a locus or a center point of the activity in that particular place. But after that, like later, my mom and I lived in another place that had haunted activity much later in my teens. But between those situations, after my parents got divorced and my mom got remarried, she married a professor that taught at Hanover College, this little Presbyterian college in southern Indiana. So we moved to Hanover and I lived in a partially finished basement in that house. And one night when I was about 9 or 10 years old, I'd fallen asleep. And this was strange for me. I'd fallen asleep on one of those old husband pillows, they were called. They were really popular in the 70s and 80s. They were often like corduroy and there are these pillows that had arms on them. I loved that pillow. I fell asleep on the pillow, and so I was partially inclined, and that may have something to do with why I was able to remember this encounter. I woke up, and I looked past my bed, and there were two grays, for lack of a better term. There are two beings that look like the conventional understanding of a gray, and one of them appeared to be floating, and one of them appeared to have its feet on the floor. The one had a chrome kind of wand in its hand. And I'm not exactly sure what the wand did. So this whole encounter, this maybe is like 10 seconds, 15 seconds, something like this, right? I wake up, I see these two beings. They don't engage with me. They're not talking to me. It's not like those light beings from what I was for. There's no like message of love. There's nothing happening there. They're just staring at me. One of them raises the wand and one of them starts moving towards me. And I started panicking because A, they're not engaging with me. B, one of them's coming towards me. And the thing that actually scared me most, I think when I woke up, I actually had like a sense of wonder about it, maybe because I was thinking about it in relation to that thing that had happened earlier in my life. But then I see the one being and then the other being, and the one that's moving towards me has this kind of like weird, almost marionette-like motion to it. And that's what freaked me. Like the motion was so different than the way that we move. And I think that it was coming towards me without talking to me was really freaky really quickly. And then as that happened, the wand goes up, being moving towards me, and I kind of blacked out. And that's the first experience that I remember, but it's certainly not the only one that happened along those lines. And I have a lot of partial memories of situations like that, both in that room and in other much more foreign spaces. From starting then, and then there was another situation that happened a couple of weeks after that. And then some of that activity seemed to, I at least didn't remember it, or there was less of it in most of my teen years. And then it picked up like crazy when I was in my early to mid 20s and actually living in New York City, in Brooklyn. And it would seemingly follow me wherever. Like one of the places that I had the most amount of these encounters was in southwestern Ohio. And so it seemed to not have a locality. I was the common denominator there. And that really, all of those experiences together and other ones have really kind of informed my life a lot. I had a lot of questions growing up. And of course, when I was in my teens, there wasn't as much online. And my stepdad got online super, super early, back in actually the late 80s. So he was a really, really early adopter to the internet and had CompuServe and Prodigy and then AOL and all those services. And I joined them as a young kid too. But there wasn't much that I could find at the time. And the stuff that I could find was really low quality for the most part. And so, you know, I definitely remembered back to that in co-founding the Experiencer Group.
Thank you for sharing that. What was it like for you trying to balance that with just, you know, something like that happens, you still have to get up and go to school or to work? How are you managing that within the context of just your life continually?
It's a great question. Not very well in my 20s. At the time, I was going to art school and then film school. And I was doing really well in terms of art at the time. I was mainly doing video art. And I was in a show before I even graduated art school. I was in a show organized by the Museum of Modern Art in New York. And I was in other museum shows in Europe, elsewhere, and at gallery shows. I was doing really well considering my age and what I was doing. And as these experiences picked up, I really fell hard in terms of being able to work, being able to focus. I'd always been a really avid reader. And I found it harder to read books just because I would zone out and kind of dissociate. I started drinking a lot more, and that was challenging in and of itself. But I think there are a lot of people that have had non-human entity encounters that get into substance abuse and alcohol issues. And I've talked about it with a few. I've actually talked about it with quite a few. And like, there's kind of this subconscious feeling or desire that if you make your body toxic enough, they're not going to want it anymore, or that you're going to be able to forget these situations. It's going to help you navigate. And so I had a really challenging time. Also, I lost friends over this. Like I said, I'd had shared experiences, and some people that I had shared experiences with were interested in what they saw. And some people were very, very frightened by what they saw or what they experienced. And I can't blame them. I can totally understand why that would be the case. You know, if something really scary happened to you and then it happened again and it had never happened before. And I was pretty open saying, if something like that happened, I would say, yeah, this kind of happened a lot around me. And yeah, some people didn't like that very much. And I lost some close friends over it. And also there's a lot of fear about, you know, am I going to be able to have like a romantic relationship? Am I going to be able to have a girlfriend? You know, why would anybody date me if they knew about, like, I would panic about kind of the ethics of when do you tell somebody if it doesn't happen and they don't know that if they don't experience it and it doesn't happen, then you probably shouldn't tell them about it. Right. Because why are they going to believe you? You know, there's all these questions. And I did have some partners that really freaked out in having some experiences with me. And that was challenging as well. There was a lot of doubt and fear about whether I was going to be able to have a family or things along those lines. So yeah, I would say that during that time in my 20s, I wasn't taking it super well. Other people, partially depends on the modality, I think. A lot of people can manage these things relatively well. If we're talking precognitive dreams, there can be some worry associated with that. Like, what if I can or can't stop this? this kind of chicken and the egg problem of if I have a dream and then if it comes true, could I have stopped it or should I have stopped it? Because there are a lot of associations and specific pieces of baggage that different experiencers can face, you know? And there are other people that it's just like a magical understanding of the world, you know, like it is just peaches and cream and rainbows all the time. And I love that too. I think that's amazing too. And that's something that doesn't get talked about enough in some ways is that some people, some of these folks are just, they lead really charmed lives and that's awesome. And sometimes some other experiencers have something to gain from learning about that experience from those folks.
Yeah, I really resonate with that. I will eventually talk more about my own experience. I know that you and I have talked about it, and I would characterize my experiences as being really positive. It changed my life in really positive ways, and I wouldn't call it traumatic really at all. But at the same time, it has been isolating. It's really difficult when you have an experience that informs so much of your worldview and your beliefs and just how you see yourself in the world. And it's so far outside of consensus reality. I've been really lucky in that most of my close family and friends have done a really just gold star job of being just as understanding and supportive of me as they absolutely can be. But at the same time, when you get to a place with somebody that you're really close to and you realize that like they don't fully believe you, you know, that they mm-hmm. don't, not necessarily that they think you're lying, but they can't go there all the way. And I don't blame them for that. I guess I'm trying to say is that even under the best of circumstances, it creates a wall between you and other people who maybe haven't had that kind of experience and have a hard time understanding what to make of it. And the thing I hear so much from experiencers who reach out to me, and not even just experiencers, but even just people who take this topic seriously, that when you've had that kind of flip in your worldview, kind of like we talked about in the last episode, that it can be isolating and it makes people really lonely. And so I really appreciate you being so open talking about all this, because I think the more we can put this stuff out into the zeitgeist and have greater conversations about it, people won't have to feel so lonely, hopefully, with these experiences. That's the hope anyways.
I hope so too. And I'm really glad for outlets like yours. I think you're doing great work for the community in terms of outreach and people really just kind of diving into the field and people that have been in it for a long time. You do such a great job of navigating that. It reminds me of the community of the experiencer group in many ways, because there are people that are just joining this wider reality, you know, and there are people that are longtime veterans of dealing with this stuff. And I love and can deeply appreciate the balance that you have there. I think it's amazing.
Thank you. I really appreciate that, friend. It means a lot coming from you.
Sure, of course. You know, it is really challenging in terms of the stigma and even people that you know. So often it's family members or some friends, things like that, situations where the line that people often say is like, I believe that you believe it happened, right? Or I know that you believe it happened. And then some of those people will kind of like pat themselves in the back for thinking such a charitable thought of somebody else, you know?
Right.
And depending on who's telling me that line or in the past, I have a lot more empathy for folks that can't manage, that can't go there these days. And so now it's fine. I used to find it deeply frustrating. And depending on the situation, even now, it can be a little frustrating. But those are the kinds of people that might have some challenges in the days ahead, right? And there's going to be, I think, a lot of them. I think people within the field of ufology, within anomalous studies, I think that there's going to be plenty of folk with kind of recent disclosure initiatives and things like that, even within the field, that are going to have challenges in terms of ontological shock and really adjusting. Because for some people, it was all fun and games and cool to think about when it was just this hidden dark secret that may or may not be true. But then when it is true, and when it does become part of consensus culture, you know, consensus reality, or this kind of like weird third reality that we find ourselves with now, I think it's going to be difficult. I know it's going to be difficult for others. And I'm happy that there are some folks within, say, the community of the experiencer group and within the community that you and I traffic in, that there are people that are prepared for this moment and prepared for the days ahead. Because as exciting as it can be to have situations like the recent House UAP hearing, which I was at and was an amazing experience, you know, as much as there's that progress, it comes with an emotional mixed bag of people of being excited that it's happening, and also kind of a little bit of, I see a little bit of resistance or even resentment in terms of being like, oh, okay, so now you can do this. All right, so now we can talk about this. Well, where were you 20 years ago when I was really deep in it? So yeah, I'm concerned and I'm curious and I'm very hopeful and optimistic about the days ahead. What do you think about that? Is it okay if I ask you a question? How are you feeling about that these days? Is that bad?
No, that's a good question. I mean, the reason I wanted to do this episode right now is because I feel like we're heading into a really critical time. It feels like disclosure has reached a sort of momentum that feels inevitable. And I think it's time to start having bigger conversations. I myself have been less willing at times, especially earlier on with this podcast, to really put myself out there, to identify as an experiencer, and to talk through what the implications of people who are interacting with this phenomenon and what their stories tell us. I mean, they're big, scary ideas. And part of it was because I do think for a lot of people, if you're not an experiencer, that it's a lot easier to kind of get into the subject from sort of the more concrete place, like through government disclosure, through nuts and bolts, through the history, through declassified documents. I mean, I think that just getting to the place where you can accept that there's a there is really important and really critical. And I wanted to make this as accessible to people as possible. But at the same time, it feels like the moment to start talking about, we have David Grush talking about not just recovered craft, but recovered bodies. And like I mentioned before, I feel like so many of us in this community and even outside of the community, we get to the place where you might be open to the idea of non-human intelligence up until the point that somebody actually interacts with one. And I think we have to get past that. We have to get past our squeamishness in terms of dealing with the reality of this situation and start having real conversations, because I think that what we're dealing with is not what people, I think it's much weirder and much more complicated and much more nuanced people think. And so I'm excited to have these conversations and put them out there.
We'll be right back after this quick break.
I completely agree with you. I couldn't agree with you more. Yeah, I absolutely agree that there are weirder times ahead and weirder realities that are going to unfold right in front of us. I definitely believe that. And, you know, it's also important to recognize that in some other cultures and in some Eastern cultures, indigenous cultures, African cosmologies, other situations, much of this is already an accepted reality. And so in some ways, we're playing catch up in our quote unquote modern society to situations that others are sometimes more comfortable navigating and have really lived in for quite a long time. Yeah. And you're right about the bodies. I mean, the bodies is a big one. Craft is one thing, you know, and I've thought about it for a long time that within, say, what people think of as the nuts and bolts community and others, that this stuff is okay when the craft is at a safe distance off in the sky and you see it through a telescope or a FLIR cam or whatever cool piece of technology, a psionics IR cam, whatever, you know. But then when it gets closer, we're not going to talk about that yet, you know. Oh, we've got flying objects, right? And we've got, and we also have submersible objects. We have USOs, right? We've got UFOs, we've got USOs. Conveniently, they're off in the ocean. Conveniently, they're off in the sky. But then as soon as they're actually near your backyard, as soon as they show up to people, that's when people sometimes hit the brakes, you know, within the field and hearing these stories. And I understand why. I was so happy to be in the room and hear that. I think a lot of people were pretty thrilled when David Grush was asked about non-human intelligence, about bodies that have been recovered. Because what's going to happen? What's going to happen when people see what those bodies look like. And what if those bodies look like what a lot of these experiencers have been reporting for decades? Where does your mind go? It's pretty hard to ignore the part where, gosh, I guess that means these experiencers were telling the truth, you know? If that's the truth, then what about all these other situations, you know? These situations that Bud Hopkins would write about, or John Mack, the cases that Yvonne Smith would take up, or Carla Turner even. There are a lot of these cases going back to Betty and Barney Hill and probably a lot further back than that.
Yeah. No, I think that's really a question that we need to start asking ourselves and start asking ourselves before whatever spin is put on it, right? Because I feel like that's almost necessarily going to happen. I'd love to hear your thoughts on the national security aspect of it, because so much of this is being presented to us through the lens of national security, but mostly through the lens of pilots and the military in particular. But the experiencer part of that conversation is really being left out of that. So what are your thoughts as an experiencer and as someone who's talking to experiencers all the time about what some of the larger implications of this might be, that the larger push for government disclosure might not be so interested in sharing with us?
Yeah, you're absolutely right that it's often being left out. And the national security issue, it's interesting because that conversation gets a lot of play on online in the kind of dominant narratives that have come out through people like Lou Elizondo and Chris Mellon and, say, David Fravor and Ryan Graves, Dave Grush. A lot of that movement, one of the kind of center points of the conversation, is about national security. And that becomes this kind of hot potato topic and this hot potato question. You know, is it a national security threat? Is it a threat? Well, they're tracked moving over nuclear bases, and they seem to, according to people like Robert Salas and others, they'll turn off the nukes or turn them on or make a big display and run off, and that's scary. Or they seem to be, there's all these incidents. And there's, of course, the problem within that of like, well, are, you know, people have been seeing that because there's advanced sensor arrays around military and nuclear facilities, right? And so is it a question of people looking for their keys right around the streetlight because that's where they can see, right? and that there might be all these other cases out there, and there are, and there absolutely are. But the national security aspect, or just the security aspect in general, that question becomes moot when you recognize that, to be perfectly frank, a lot of these beings come to people's homes and they don't use a doorbell. And the situation is that people in our country and in most other parts of the world, they take home invasion pretty seriously. And it's when somebody walks into your home without telling you that they're coming over, without knocking on the door, without ringing the doorbell, you can make some basic assumptions. Maybe you can't figure the whole thing out, but there's generally the kind of inherent response of assuming that they're not coming over to borrow some sugar or something, that something's happening here and that it might even be nefarious. There's still plenty of room for conversation in terms of like, well, why are they doing this? And is this, why have they done this in the past? Is it still happening now? Why were they doing it? And the implications there is it something so serious that the ends justified the means? There are a lot of questions that way. And I'm happy to entertain that conversation, but that is an important conversation. And at first, we need to get to the point where people can brace themselves and realize that, yeah, there are bodies, that this isn't speculation. They exist. And thousands, maybe millions of people the world over have described these various beings over the years. And they're telling their truth. And they're not just telling their truth, they're telling the truth about this. And we don't know exactly why this is happening. And I don't think that, I truly believe that a lot of the stories where a lot of experiencers that are of the abductee variety that have had non-human entity contact, that there are longstanding stories about some of those people being tracked by various agencies or people within various agencies going back decades. And I've heard enough from some pretty high placed people that I think that that's absolutely the case. I don't know that to be case because I wasn't there, but I've heard enough to have the working assumption that that's true. So there are some inconvenient truths when we talk about this, because within our country, in other countries, people pay taxes and they, you know, they get to go to college from that tax money, or they get to, at the least, they've got some basic infrastructural assurances. The potholes are going to get filled and things like that. And to a degree, we have that here in the States. However, a lot of our tax money goes to the military, and a lot of that money goes to defense contractors. And I'm not here to, you know, I try to steer clear of the kind of like classified angle with that. I know that getting into the topic of confidential weaponry is often bad for people's health, right? But a lot of our tax money does go to that. And it's under the idea that we're going to be protected, right? And if people aren't safe in their own homes, well, that's the part where people are going to start getting worried. And I can totally understand that. When people talk about there being panic in the streets around this topic, it's when it gets weird. And it's not just the high strangeness effects of recognizing that a lot of this stuff seems to be using physics and science that we don't understand, or that there even seems to be some element that can manipulate time or space-time. And also that some of these beings seem to be able to, you know, kind of pull off near-perfect crimes, that they're pulling off heists left and right. And not only that, maybe there's other non-human intelligence that is less embodied. And what if there is, as I believe, that there's kind of an overlapping realm with us that we coincide with? And what about those beings, right? Is there anything there? And if there is, can they see us? There are a lot of questions there. And I don't think that for too many years ahead that that's going to go unnoticed. I think we're a few revelations and a few scientific breakthroughs from really having our world rock on a collective consciousness level.
Yeah, absolutely. And with all that in mind, I'd love to circle back to something you touched on a little earlier, and that I know that you and I have talked about privately a little bit, which is the nature of the disclosure movement. You know, we're both obviously huge supporters of what's going on in Washington right now, but there's also kind of this third reality that's being created that you mentioned a little earlier. And I'd love to hear your thoughts on that, because it feels like there are a lot of reasons why they wouldn't want to tell us everything all at once. Good reasons that go beyond the whole, like, everything is a psyop, you know, the argument that seems to be out there. And I was hoping you could talk about that a little bit, the subtleties of that, and what you mean by the third reality.
Sure. Yeah, when I'm talking about the possibility of a third reality, it's just something that came up around the time of the hearing and a little bit beforehand and especially afterwards. And, you know, I love our conversations on the phone. For those out there, Kelly and I talk pretty frequently, and I love my conversations with Kelly. And one thing that I was thinking about the other day and has come up in group, meaning the board meetings that I host, that, you know, for a lot of experiencers, and a lot of people that, like Mitch Horowitz, would consider seekers, meaning basically anybody that's listening to your podcast, anybody seeking out answers or seeking out these mysteries of anomalous experiences, there's consensus reality, right? There's the reality that we have, and you've talked about this plenty before, the consensus reality that happens when we go to the store or we go to work, we're out in culture, the reality that we read about in the newspaper or we see on the news. And then there's our private beliefs, our private realities. For experiencers, that will entail maybe many years of strangeness that show that the world is a lot stranger than it's made out to be in the press, et cetera, in common culture. And there are other forms of this as well. I mean, some people could relate that they had religious beliefs in their families that might not be totally acceptable out in polite society or at the grocery store. that there might be spiritual beliefs, or there might be political beliefs even that are inconvenient or rub against the grain of what's accepted in certain situations. So I think a lot of people can understand the situation that in many ways we share the consensus reality. And for a lot of people, it's just a little bit of a stretch, or it's totally cool. And for some people, it takes a lot of effort. And now we have this seemingly this burgeoning third reality. And it's this reality that was being talked about at the House UAP hearing recently. And it's the burgeoning reality that's coming up in Chuck Schumer's legislation with his Disclosure Act. He even used the word disclosure. Oh my gosh, people are cheering. You know, it's like a ticker tape parade within the field, seeing that for a lot of folks. And that third reality, it's because the government, our government, the US government, the military, other world governments have been so adamant in pushing back against this for the most part for so many decades. There would be leaked documents. A lot of leaked stuff comes out from military reports and things like that over the years. And some people cover those really, really well. Like my old buddy, Sean Rosch on Witness Citizen, does a great job looking at old military reports and things like that. But for the most part, we've been denied acknowledgement from quote unquote, the authorities, right? But now it's like, we can have a little bit. We can have a little bit. And it seems to be carefully managed to be somewhere between the lived reality of people and the consensus reality that we've known before. So all before, it's like we were on 2 feet and we figured out what our balance was on those 2 feet. And now in some ways, there are folks behind the scenes that I believe that some or many of these people are very well-intentioned. And like a lot of other situations on Capitol Hill, there are probably some other people that are just looking at this as something that they can take advantage of. But it's going to be a range of folks, and it seems that it already has been a range of folks, that are collaborating behind the scenes on this weird new third reality. And we don't even necessarily, we don't quite know what that reality is going to be. And like, how good of a job is it going to be at being halfway between one and the other? And is it going to be something that we're all psyched about? Is it something that's going to be a process like it's been in terms of kind of a slow drip of reveals? And there in the Schumer legislation, it sounds like there's the presumption of transparency and immediacy and, you know, this kind of language that gets baked in there. So I'm really curious. And I think that there's a lot of reasons to be interested, cautiously optimistic, and for some people to even be deeply skeptical about this third reality.
Yeah. And I think that's such an important insight. And I was so excited by that the first time I heard you talk about it, because I was like, yes, exactly. I feel like in the community, we fall victim a lot to, and just a consensus reality in general, we fall victim so much to this black and white thinking where either the people who are behind the disclosure movement are either 100% telling the truth or they're lying. And that's just not really how the world works. It's far more complicated than that. And even if everyone involved has the very best of intentions, the nature of this, trying to tell people things in the right order and in the right way so that they're actually able to hear it, so that they're actually able to metabolize it and integrate it, that's complicated. And a lot of these are people who, most of them are very deeply tied to the intelligence community and the military and national defense and all that. So they're probably juggling objectives that we on the outside don't much have awareness of, right? And so I think there's this mentality that some people have that everything that's coming out of this necessarily is a psyop and that it's all a lie. Or there's people who are like, it's all absolutely the truth. And I think that the reality is somewhere in the middle, and that we have to understand that what we're going to get from the government isn't going to be like pure unadulterated disclosure, right? Like, that's not what it's going to be. We're going to get some version of that that's been heavily workshopped and curated. And that doesn't mean that the people behind it have some bad intention. It just means that this has been done necessarily by committee, because that's literally what democracy is, right? But for people who want to have a deeper and more sophisticated view of this, and who are very closely following what's going on in Washington, what do you recommend that they look into and that they read or that they think about? Like, where should people start if they want to try to have more of an adult understanding of what's going on?
I think that's a great question. I think that's a fantastic question. There are a few recent texts that are pretty great. I mean, there's wonderful podcasts like your own, of course. I think coming at it from the experiencer mindset as if there is only one. There's absolutely not. There's a huge range. But a somewhat lesser known podcast that happened for, I guess, about two and a half years called Aliens and Artists, that Stuart Davis, who is a co-founder of the Experiencer Group, he's working in film now. But he did this great, great podcast called Aliens and Artists that I think is fantastic. And he had regular interviews with fellow experiencers. He himself had similar encounters to mine. And that's kind of how we came to know each other. In fact, he was in the Zoom room at the very first experiencer support meeting that I ever hosted with Kirsten Blackburn, and who we both kind of worked under the historian Richard Dolan, right? Who does great work. And if people he put out UFOs in the National Security State, volumes 1 and 2. He's done a lot of podcasts himself. And we were doing site work for his member site. So anyway, long story short, Stuart was in that first support session, and he was already wrestling with this topic, already started this podcast. And I love it in terms of looking at the deeper issues. And so there are other folks. I think the work of Jeff Kripal is really great this way. The work of Whitley Strieber. In fact, they wrote a book together called The Supernatural. I know you know this. That fun factoid was edited by our mutual friend, Mitch Horowitz.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Right. Mitch Horowitz edited The Supernatural. How cool is that? It's called The Supernatural, Why the Unexplained is Real. And they kind of go back and forth, and they're basically doing kind of like throw and catch, going back and forth chapter to chapter and addressing what the last person has just written and positing something new. And so it creates this really amazing dialogue. And it's really about looking at the world through the kind of supernatural, anomalous experiences lens. And Jeff's most recent book, The Superhumanities, is a great take on looking at how to navigate the world of anomalous experiences when it comes to academia and various subjects, specifically in the humanities. So if folks have a real bent towards that direction, I think that that would be a great place to start. There's also another book that came out this year that I love, is called Deep Weird, The Varieties of High Strangeness Experience. And it was edited by an anthropologist named Jack Hunter, who I think is really an underknown and great resource. He thinks of himself as a para-anthropologist and takes pains to point out that many anthropologists are kind of by default para-anthropologists, because there's a long history within the field of anthropology of taking in and reporting anomalous experiences from various cultures without judgment and just kind of reporting as people report to them. And so he did this great book called Deep Weird, and it's got contributions from Jeff Kripal, Jack himself, Sharon Hewitt-Rowlett, who we both know, who's amazing, and her work is great itself, Joshua Cutchin, Anthony Peake, and others. I think it's a really great compendium that I haven't yet seen a lot of people reference yet, but I think The Varieties of High Strangeness Experience, it's called Deep Weird. That's another good one. And as far as media goes, you know, it's a little bit challenging, because apart from narrative fictional films and TV shows, there is a bit of a lack in terms of grounded, thoughtful, long-form explorations of experiencer lives and the issues that experiencers face. And I certainly hope to see more of that in the future. And so for right now, you know, as far as other resources, there's places like the Experiencer Group and, say, Opus and Yvonne Smith's group. We're not the only one out there. And I'm glad that there's more communities like the Experiencer Group there as well.
Well, those are amazing. All of those. I co-sign on all of that. I will make sure that there's links in the episode brief to all of the resources that Jay just mentioned, and also obviously links to the Experiencer Group. So if any of you heard that and resonated with that and feel like that's something that you think might be a good support for you, I really can't recommend it enough. Jay, thank you so much for coming. I'm so glad we got to do this. Like you said, we have these kind of conversations on the phone all the time, and it's fun to be able to share this with everyone else. And I'm just so appreciative to you for your openness and your friendship and just your compassion and intelligence. You've been not just a great friend, but really a fantastic mentor for me through all of this. And I'm just so grateful to have you and to have you on the show.
Oh, I really deeply love what you're doing. I think that you're truly one of the best new voices that we have in this community. I think what you do is invaluable. And I'm so, so thrilled to have you as such a great friend. I'm really happy to be on the show today. It's one of my very favorite podcasts ever of any topic. And so it's really great to be here today. Thank you so much, Kelly. Thank you so much.